Today on Maine Calling, LGBTQ plus history in Maine and the places that mattered. During Pride Month, rainbow flags pop up all around Maine on homes, businesses, and gathering places, expressing support and safety for the LGBTQ plus community. And there are Pride events scheduled for every county in Maine. But of course, this was not always the case. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we examine LGBTQ plus history in our state, and especially the places that played a significant role in it. Ogunquit, Portland, Ellsworth, and Bangor are just a few of the places where people gathered to create safe spaces decades ago. They hosted church dances, published gay newspapers, and started college clubs. What was the role of these safe spaces then and now? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Before LGBTQ plus people could live openly in Maine, there were certain places that helped them feel safe and find community. Today, we will learn about those places and this history and find out what's happening for Pride Month in Maine. Joining me for the hour, Gia Drew, who is Executive Director for Equality Maine, Dr. Wendy Chapkiss, who is a professor and expert on gender, sexuality, and LGBTQ rights at the University of Southern Maine, and Megan McGregor, Instruction and Outreach Librarian at the University of Southern Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about Maine's LGBTQ plus history? Is there a place that is especially important to you? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you today. And I'm going to start with you, Megan, because you put together a timeline, which is really, really interesting about some of these places and some of these events that brought us to where we are today. And let's go back to the 1800s, because I think a lot of people would be surprised. I think many people would think that this timeline might start in the mid-20th century, but you're starting in the 19th century. What people and what places are important for all of us to know about?
First of all, thanks for having me. Lovely. I'm excited to be here. And yeah, queer people have been around forever. So of course we're in Maine, in the territory of Maine in the 1800s, even when we were still owned by Massachusetts back in the day. So some of kind of the early 1800s-y stuff is the classic one that a lot of people may think of, Sarah Orange Jewett, the famous Maine author, here in Maine, Historic New England has her house, so you can go see it. It's lovely. There's also Edith's Love Life, which was the first kind of lesbian novel that was published by another Mainer, by Messy Sweet. She was in Portland, so she was around and operating, and it's kind of it's one of those classic early lesbian books where it's like, it's kind of hinted at, it's deeply in tone that it is, it never really comes out, and there's like, the dirty laundry is never put out kind of thing, but it's there. Also, there's a newspaper account of a man up in the Gardner area who cross-dressed. He was a Civil War veteran, and he wore dresses, which actually I don't have on the timeline because I haven't added it yet, but it's there. So there's a lot of kind of sparks and pokes up of us in the timeline in the early period.
Is there, in this newspaper article about James Robbins, is there any indication about how he was received by people in his community?
There was a lot of like, oh, it's just James. And like it's kind of that thing that to the modern audiences are kind of unexpected, that there was so much acceptance as well as kind of people who weren't okay with it, but like he kind of did it on his own in his own way, and his friends were like, yeah, that's just what he does. It's his thing.
Yeah,
It wasn't like a big deal.
late 1800s, your timeline. I'm going to fast forward because suddenly, around 1970, a whole bunch happens in Maine. So, could you tell us some of the important places, some of the important events that you found important enough to put on your timeline? And all kind of happening at once.
So it's the sparks of Stonewall. It's what's doing it. So the Maine is really interesting in that we have direct connection to the people who are coming right out of Stonewall and forming all the intense stuff in New York City. So starting in 1971, 1972, two groups form up in the Ellsworth, Orono, Bangor area. There was a unofficial group formed by Carol A. Savoy, who formed a group for in like a summer camp thing that you may or know was experimenting with at the time, where you get your friends, you learn how to make bread. But hers was on homosexuality. So they met in her apartment in Old Town, Maine, at the same time, roughly. Sturgis Haskins had returned to his home in Sorrento, Maine. He ran into two other gay men that he never thought he could find, and had this epiphany of like, if there's two, three of us, there's got to be more of us. So they formed Hancock County Gays in that area, and then the Hancock County Gays and the Carol A. Savoy's group found each other within a year's time. So in 1972, they form, or in 1973, they form Gay Support and Action up in that area, that then bleeds into forming a group at UMaine Orono, the Wild Stein Club, which is still around today. And it's the Wild Stein Club's formation that really kicks off everything. They form an official a university club, which causes a lot of controversy. They hold a symposium, which is a giant meeting that they get tons of people coming. They get like 300 people coming to this, which is out of wild for the time. And basically, everybody who's gay in Maine finds each other at this symposium because they get such a ton of press in the straight newspapers. And like it gets national news, and they have all these big wigs from New York City coming up to talk at it. And so from there, also later that year in 74, because of the Maine Gay Symposium, you have the formation of the first Maine queer newspaper. The Maine Gay Task Force newsletter that goes out that connects the community throughout the state, even when we're not in the same space with everyone like we are in this in like months like this. So all of a sudden we have a newsletter we can tap into, which starts off a tradition. You have and then kind of and they push for a bunch of rights, a couple things that happen. They get the sodomy laws taken off the books that involve homosexuality because it was still illegal at that point. So that comes off of the Maine sodomy law. And then after that, there's a bit of a fallow period. AIDS shows up in Maine in 1983. And then we go into 1984, which is this what I kind of have started to think of as the second wave of rights activism in Maine, with the death of Charlie Howard in July 7th of 1984. That's what directly creates what is now Equality Maine, which at the time was MLGPA, Maine Lesbian Gay Political Alliance, and that's kind of becomes the second wave that we're kind of in at the moment, that brings us the Civil Rights Act, and also the marriage equality in Maine.
I want to go back just a little bit and bring you in the conversation, Wendy, when we're talking about the Wild Stein Club at UMaine. I'm wondering, how does that fit in when you look at the nation in general, the existence of the club at UMaine? Were other universities in the same place that UMaine was, or was UMaine a little bit ahead?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think certainly UMaine was in that, what Megan has called the first wave of campus organizing. What was surprising about it, I think, for many people, is that it was Maine. I remember Steve Bull, who was one of the founders of the Wild Stein Group, one of the early members, said that he went around on a speaking tour of campuses in Maine shortly after the symposium because it got a lot of press. And people were convinced that he was from away, that he couldn't possibly be from Maine, and that his fellow members of the Wildstein Club must have been all from New York City or something. And he was like, "We are so Maine, you know, potato farmers from the Bangor area," in his case. So the idea that there was local grassroots organizing around queer issues took people by surprise in the state. Yeah, it was happening elsewhere, but people didn't believe it could possibly actually be from Maine, and it was.
And Chia, I want to ask you about the foundation of your organization, Equality Maine. Obviously, coming from a very, very dark moment in Maine history, the death of Charlie Howard. Tell me what you can about the formation of Equality Maine and that point.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad Megan brought this up. In the summer of '84, the horrible death of Charlie, where he was dropped off a bridge in Bangor, really did ignite the movement. And as we know, this was not the first time some LGBTQ person had been hurt by violence, but this really became the flashpoint here in Maine. It also got a lot of national news. And what I've learned talking to some of the founders of Equality Maine and MLGPA was, what do we do? What do we do now after such a horrible death of a young, innocent gay man to make sure that anybody can walk down any street in Maine and not fear for their life? A group of folks, some of them are still here in Maine, like Barb Wood, founded the Maine Lesbian Gay Political Alliance to do those things. What do we do to make sure that people know what it's like to be LGBTQ, to really sort of talk about and sort of dismantle the stereotypes? And I think that's the reason Charlie got killed, because of fear and ignorance. There was a great fear around LGBTQ people. So what do we do to like talk about what it's like to be LGBTQ, that we do live in every community in the state of Maine? What do we do to connect people so people don't feel alone in a very large rural state? And then, most definitely, what do we do to make sure that there are laws and policies that affirm our dignity as human beings? And that was really the driving force of Equality Maine from the very beginning, is how do we make sure we have those civil rights protections in Maine law? So that's kind of what we all started. I think they started with a little like spiral notebook and wrote a few notes down. And I think they had a little table at Common Ground Fair that fall in 1984 to spread the word. And so, we were in our 40th anniversary year, and we're trying to honor our history, but we're also still fighting for our rights and our future.
Wendy, I want to. We're talking a lot on this program today about this idea of space, place. And, even though laws were changed, there were still places where people in the community felt comfortable, and then there are places where people did not. And so, if you could, I think obviously Ogunquit is really well known as a place where gay and lesbian people have felt comfortable for a long time. If you could talk about the role of Ogunquit and maybe what are some other places in Maine where, when we're talking about the 70s, the 80s, were places of refuge.
Well, I'll let Megan talk about Ogunquit because I don't know
Okay.
that situation so well, but I would like to talk about Portland, because very early in 1967 or 1968, Portland had its first gay bar. It's called Roland's Tavern. It was created by a Mainer named Roland Labby. This was before the Stonewall Uprising in New York. So we're talking, early queer history in the city of Portland. And he was determined to open a gay bar, and the city was less than excited about it. It was a bar that was located right on Cumberland and Forest Avenue, the corner there. The city wouldn't give him a dancing license, but he knew queer people were going to dance. So what they did is they installed a light on the dance floor that would flash a red light if police or somebody that came in that they didn't know. So people would separate off the dance floor, pull the tables together, and sit down and look like they were just having a drink. So he was a definite trailblazer in the city of Portland in creating safe space, queer space in town. And he did it at great personal cost. He was queer bashed a number of times, seriously injured, 5 ribs broken one time. His brick was thrown in his face, and he had 22 facial fractures. It was not for the faint of heart, and he persevered, and he did it. Created queer space, then created another gay bar later called the Phoenix. Anyway, started Portland on the path to having actual queer space. Also, the city council in Portland pretty early on had out an out gay member, Barb Wood, as Gia Drew mentioned her. I think she got elected in 1988. So it meant that City Hall became a place where queer people had a voice, and that was really important. It remained very dangerous for people to be queer in Portland, even in the early 1990s. Queer bashings happened frequently. And actually, queer bashings in 1992, there was a man who was assaulted by 7 individuals, and the police caught them, but the man was unwilling to press charges because he was afraid his employer would learn he was gay, and there were no anti-discrimination protections for anybody in the state of Maine. And so at that moment, Portland decided they needed to pass local anti-discrimination legislation. And that was due to the fact that Barb Wood and other queer members of city council took it up and insisted that people needed protections within the city so that they could bring charges against assailants, for instance.
Wow, such recent history. Megan, I will turn to you. What were the early safe spaces in, I don't want to just use the word safe and fun spaces in Ogunquit.
Well, it's Ogunquit was interesting in that it's kind of Maine version of P-Town, where it's an artist colony. It's really close to the Massachusetts border, where all the tourists are coming from. So I think it ends up being a space because there's a lot of artists there, so that usually has a good portion of queer community in there. And it's away from your home, so it's very discreet. So if you get caught, not everybody in town knows who you are. So you can kind of be discreet, which is a classic emblem of queer spaces in the early days, because Algonquin kind of becomes an artist community in the, if I remember correctly, like early 1900s. So there's a lot of people going up there. So from there, kind of the bar scene starts to show up. The same time that Roland's Tavern is open, there's a couple of queer bars that have opened up in Algonquin, but it's interesting in that some of them are queer bars, like Roland's Tavern was a queer bar where you can do what you want, you're queer, you can be in here, versus spaces that were tolerant. So there's a really interesting like a queer version of like almost a green book, that's safe places you can go and be in Maine, that was published by the GCN gay community newspaper down in Boston. That lists places up in Maine, and they list several places in Algonquin. One of those is Valerie's, which are places that you can go as gay people and be in, and you won't be drummed out because, as Wendy said, there were at that point there's no protection, so you can be thrown out of a place if you're perceived as being gay. But they were you were allowed to go in there if you were gay, but you couldn't dance together. No hanky panky, no contact. But you can be in the space. So there were a lot of those spaces in Algonquin, as well as the ones that would like let you dance, let you touch all of that stuff.
And you're
So,
talking about sort of the 1980s, Megan?
no, this is like early 1970s period.
Okay, all right. I'm going to go now to Ellie Roy, who's calling in. She's communications coordinator for Out Maine. Ellie, thanks so much for calling in and kind of representing the younger generation. You have the advantage of following after people who had to break barriers, but there are also new challenges today. When you are listening to Wendy and Megan and Gia, what are you thinking about the climate now for LGBTQ plus youth?
Of course, yeah, my pleasure to be here. You know, in a lot of ways, we're very lucky to live where we do, but you know, there are a bunch of bills being proposed right now in the legislature that are very deeply discriminatory and anti-trans. In fact, there was just a hearing about these bills back on May 8th, but thankfully, supporters of queer and trans rights who showed up to testify against those bills outnumbered people in favor of the bills 6-1. And I think the majority of Maine supports LGBTQ plus people, which is a lot more than people in other states can say. We're very lucky to be here. On the other hand, in the more rural areas of Maine, you know, there's still a lot of community pushback. Maine is unique, I think, in that it's a very polarized mixed bag, but largely, especially because of such active support that we're seeing right now, I do think that we're heading in the right direction slowly but surely.
You know, today we're talking a little bit about physical spaces and spaces that serve as centers or safe places. What are those for younger generation?
Yeah, so a lot of younger folks, especially for Out Maine's programs, we collaborate with a lot of libraries, a lot of outdoor parks. Our summer event series called Out in the Park, we're heading to half a dozen places all throughout the state, partnering with different organizations there to create those gathering places for queer youth and their families to come and do educational fun activities. You know, I think our goal here at Out Maine is providing communities with the tools and education they need to support queer youth who live there and to help them feel like they belong in those places. So it's a huge part of our mission to go to the rural areas and the urban areas alike to help create those safe places.
And Ellie, before we let you go, anything you want to highlight for Pride Month?
Yeah, so Out Maine is going to be at almost 40 Pride events throughout this month. So if you see one of our tables, if you see us marching in a parade, please do not hesitate to come say hello. And then for Out in the Park, like I mentioned, we're going to be in Waterville, Searsmont, Ellsworth, Presque Isle, Cushing, and Bethel with a bonus youth-led event in York. That's all throughout the summer, and it's for all ages. So please register, and we will see you this summer.
Well, thanks so much for calling in. That was Ellie Roy, Communications Coordinator for Out Maine. We do need to take a quick break. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the places that played an important role in Maine's LGBTQ plus history in Maine. We're also talking more broadly about the history and where we are today. My guests are Megan McGregor, Instruction and Outreach Librarian at USM. She is with the LGBTQ plus Collection Advisory Committee. Dr. Wendy Chapkis is Professor of Sociology and Women and Gender Studies, also at USM, and Gia Drew is Executive Director for Equality Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Wendy, I know that you were dying to jump in when Ellie was talking to us, but I had to go to a break. So here's your chance.
Oh, I just wanted to add a couple of more places that younger queer people might want to explore. One is Outright, which has existed for decades, and there's a chapter in Portland that is really active and very, very good. I think there's also one in Lewiston, Auburn, and maybe other places as well. And the other thing is the Equality Community Center in Portland, a newish, 4 or 5 years old.
We're going to hear from them in just a minute. So okay, that's great.
Say,
yeah,
very
that's great.
Welcoming yeah. to queer folks and Maine Transnet. They are an excellent resource for young trans people in Portland.
On the line with us now is Alyssa Sweet, who is Southern Maine Site Manager for Historic New England, which manages the Sarah Orne Jewett House. Thanks for calling in, Alyssa.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so we heard a little bit about Sarah Orne Jewett earlier in the program from Megan, but I was wondering if you would like to expand on that. Describe her role as a pioneer, not just as an author, but also as a woman who lived her life the way she wanted to live her life.
That's actually exactly how I describe her. She didn't really let barriers kind of keep her in the way that like society wanted women to be during her time. And she spent the majority of her year actually living in Boston with her partner, Annie Fields, and they lived in what was called a Boston marriage. And then during the springtime, she would come back up to South Berwick and she would do a lot of her writing up here. But for the rest of the year, her and Annie would live together. They would travel together. And they actually created this group of friends that were very similar to them. A lot of artists, a lot of authors, a lot of philosophers. And they would all gather together on Sundays and just talk about different ideas and how they wanted the world to change, really uplifting and inspiring each other. It's almost magical in a way that we don't typically hear about this, especially in the Victorian time period. And when we have visitors come visit the house and we talk about this, their eyes kind of like light up because it's a really sweet, loving story about Sarah and Annie and their friends and just the writings and the work and the art that they were able to produce from it.
And of course, we're talking about the mid-18 and late 1800s. Alyssa, what do we know about how she and Annie were treated by others?
So they were actually treated pretty well. It's my understanding that at the time period, women weren't thought of to be really sexual unless you were partnered with your husband, especially, or a man. So Sarah and Annie were allowed to live their lives kind of accepted because nobody thought that it was anything really more than just like a deep friendship. Of course, they thought of each other as partners. We believe that they exchanged rings. But their families and their friends really accepted them. It would have been a completely different scenario if they were men, but because they were women, it was kind of allowed and accepted, especially by their friends and family.
And I understand that this is a pretty big month for you at the Jewett House. Tell us what's happening.
Yes, it is. So we're so excited. This is our fourth year putting on our annual Pride Garden Party. We partner with New Hampshire Outright, and this year it's on Friday 13th from 5 to 7 p.m. And we open up the house for tours, but there's also like a party. So we have cocktails, we have food. The highlight of the evening is we have actresses dress up and come play as Sarah and Annie. So our visitors can interact with them. They can ask them questions, and you can just watch them walk around the garden. They are going to do a poetry reading of poems that Sarah and Annie wrote inspired by each other, which is really sweet. And it's just a great opportunity for the community to come together and not only celebrate people from the LGBTQ community in the past, but also people now and in that community and just celebrating love. It's a great
event. And
Alyssa,
does this event sell out? Do people need to get their tickets soon?
We prefer if people get their tickets and buy them now. Usually we have some space at the door, but if you are absolutely sure that you want to come, we definitely recommend that you get tickets.
Thanks so much for calling in. That's Alyssa Sweet with the Sarah Orange Jewett House Museum and Visitor Center in North Berwick. Well, we've got another call calling in, as promised, Christopher O'Connor, Executive Director for the Equality Community Center in Portland. Hi, Christopher. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we're talking about the importance of certain places in Maine for the LGBTQ plus community, especially throughout history. Talk about your center, how it came about, what role it plays.
Yeah, the Equality Community Center was founded as an organization, as a nonprofit organization back in 2015. After we had won marriage equality back in 2012, there was a community-wide needs assessment about what's next. What are the important things for our community moving forward? And amongst a lot of high priority things that came out of that needs assessment, there were two things that came out that were not things that other nonprofit organizations were doing in the state of Maine. And those two things were the need for physical space. As Wendy and Megan were talking about earlier, queer space had been focused a lot on bars and nightclubs and bookstores and coffee shops. And as we've fought for greater equality in the state of Maine, a lot of those places have gone away. At one point, there were 30-plus LGBT nightclubs and bars in the state, and now there are, I think, three. And so this need for, and while physical space has gone away, there's still this great need for community gathering space and a place for our community to organize, to gather, to mourn, to celebrate all of the things that community need to do together. There's still that need for space. And so the second need that came up in that process and that needs assessment process was the need for housing for our older adults. places where folks can age in place with dignity and grace and not have to go back into the closet. And so at that point, the Equality Community Center was founded with that vision of working towards those needs in our community. And here we are 11 years later in 2025, after that initial needs assessment, we now have the Equality Community Center, and we've just broken ground on the Equality Commons, which will be an affordable senior living community.
Chris, we're going to hear from Ed Gardner from that community in just a minute. So I'm going to cut you off right there so you don't steal his thunder. But I wanted to ask you, the Equality Community Center, do you have events planned for Pride Month?
We absolutely do. Yeah, we are. We've got a busy, busy month. We're at 12 different Pride celebrations all across Maine to make sure that folks know about the ECC being here as a resource, as a community resource. And we've got a wide array of things throughout the month. We have 16 different tenants and partners at the center that are all contributing to our Pride programming. But on the day of Portland Pride, we have what's called Pride Inside, which starts off with a coffee and donuts, our traditional coffee and donuts before the parade and festival. We encourage folks to come to the center. And then we keep the center open all day in partnership with our friends at Maine Transnet. The Safe Combination Thrift Store will be open to provide an alternative for folks who might need a quieter, less intensive Pride experience, but still want to be a part of community, and they can land at the center during the day and take a break from the parade or the festival. And then that night, we throw the big party in Portland, the Big Gay Dance Party. It's one of our annual fundraisers. This is the third annual event where we turn the State Theater into a big dance club for the night. And it's a fundraiser to support the center. And this year, we're welcoming our special guest, Roxy Andrews from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling in. That's Chris O'Connor, Executive Director of the Equality Community Center. We're going to go now to a caller from Acton. Bernard calling from Acton. Hi, Bernard. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you, everyone. This program is great. I need to go back to the very beginning of the program, though, and just share my reaction to the references to the death of Charlie Howard. I think it's really important for those of us who were around back then to use the word murder. It's the murder of Charlie Howard, in my opinion, not the death, any more than we would refer to the death of Harvey Milk in San Francisco, for example. Mm. And the reason I just think it's really important for people to realize the magnitude of things, events like that did happen in Maine. Also, someone mentioned the Phoenix, the second bar that Roland established in Portland. And I think it's important to highlight that the reason the Phoenix disappeared was that it was burned. So not to be like doom and gloom, but I just think the magnitude of some of the history can get lost in the dialogue. The last thing I just want to mention in that regard is the references to Barb Wood being elected as an openly lesbian person to Portland City Council. I think it's important, again, to be cognizant that there were other people who ran before. I'm thinking particularly of a man named Fred Berger, who published the newspaper, Our Paper, it was called, and he hosted the meetings for Our Paper at his store called Our Books on Pine Street. And Fred was not elected to city council, largely, if not exclusively, because he was an openly gay man who was operating that newspaper out of his bookstore. So the progress we've made is phenomenal, and I'm grateful for that. And we got to move forward, particularly on the issues surrounding transsexual people. But again, I just wanted to highlight those things and their importance in the history of LGBTQ+ people here in Maine.
Bernard, thank you so much for your call, and really important to talk about how much language matters, especially the use of the word murder versus death. Thank you so much for calling in. Wendy, you were nodding pretty much the whole time Bernard was talking. You agree with much of what he was saying, but I want to ask you if you want to talk more about the, any of the people that he was talking about.
Well, absolutely. First of all, the Charlie Howard murder was, as I think Megan pointed out, really instrumental in kicking off a second wave of queer activism in the state of Maine. It also just, I think it's very timely to say, it led to probably the first Pride March. It wasn't called a Pride March at the time, but there was a memorial for Charlie Howard in the First Parish Unitarian Universalist Church on Congress Street, and after the memorial, people marched down Congress Street in public demanding rights for queer people. So very important. That murder really was galvanizing. But the
I'll also say that wasn't, Portland wasn't the only place that those marches happened after Charlie Howard. That also happened in Lewiston, and they actually went out and marched across the bridge, which is pretty impressive for the time. Given the heavily Catholic nature of that town. Also up in Bangor, same thing. They had a meeting with a lot of speeches and then a protest march to the bridge where he was murdered. So yeah, it was a huge, huge deal. And yeah, thanks for the correction, Bernard.
And the other thing I wanted to say quickly about that is Bernard's absolutely right about the constant battle to achieve basic civil rights. It took 30 years to get protections for queer people to be allowed to rent an apartment, keep their job, be served in a restaurant, and so forth. Basic, basic civil rights law. And it wasn't implemented until 2006. So we're talking recent. So yeah, we've made enormous strides, but it's been a long slog and it's not over.
Bernard, thank you so much for calling in. We do need to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. If you're quick, you can also post something on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, LGBTQ-friendly spaces in Maine throughout history. Joining me, Wendy Chapkis, USM professor focused on gender, sexuality, and LGBTQ rights. Gia Drew with Equality Maine, and Megan McGregor, USM librarian. Share your comments and questions. If you're quick, you can get in an email, talk@mainpublic.org, or just give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. Before the break, we were talking with Bernard, who had a lot of important points to make, but one of them was that the Phoenix ended by fire. Megan, you wanted to make an important clarification there.
So Bernard, you're 100% correct. The Phoenix burned in a fire, a really bad fire, where even a fireman ended up losing his life in the blaze. But unfortunately, that was an electrical fire. So luckily, it was not a nefariously set fire. Roland's Tavern, ironically, a year later also burned in a fire. That was a nefarious fire, but unfortunately that was community inflicted. It was a very drunk gay man who was kicked out of the bar for being too drunk that turned around and burned it. So unfortunately those were two that one was a set blaze. But there was a history of burning down queer bars generally. Look at the Upstairs fire in New Orleans, also here in Maine, in Algonquit, just because there were gay bars didn't mean everybody in Algonquit liked there being gay bars. So I think it was the front porch or one of those that got burned after there was a huge controversy of it being opened in the first place, that got burned in the late 70s when that happened. So yeah.
Thank you, Megan. Joining us now is Ed Gardner, who's the broker owner of Gardner Real Estate Group, and he is a big part of creating the housing for senior LGBTQ plus residents that Chris O'Connor was talking about before. Ed, Chris started talking about it, and I told him to hold off because you can tell us about what's going on.
Well, thanks, Jennifer, and thanks for welcoming me to this awesome group of people here doing good things in Maine. Yes, we started the Equality Community Center several years ago, and one of the things on the docket for our mission was to create housing for people, especially affordable housing. So the Equality Community Center hired a very experienced developer using low-income tax credits, along with the City of Portland and their tax credits. We got approved to break ground just a couple months ago to build a 54-unit, 55-plus affordable housing building.
And that is
right
Portland?
Next to the center. Yes, located at 25 Casco Street. Actually, the view of this will be looking at the old site of the Phoenix that had burned. But the community center is right next door to it, so it's a nice way to cross-market the tenants to volunteer at the center and vice versa.
And Ed, what's your timeline?
Well, we are hoping to be able to open the doors and have a ribbon cutting ceremony next July 2026, barring no problems with construction. We had a little problem with finding some ledge in the ground, which put us behind a month or so. But we're hoping a year from July, we'll be able to fill the building out.
Let's back up to when you all, the group of you working on this, establish this as a priority. Why? Why is it important to have affordable housing or housing that is specifically targeted for people who are LGBTQ? Why is that especially important today now that there are laws on the books that prevent discrimination in housing?
Well, I think that Megan and Wendy summed it up very nicely, talking about the history of LGBT life in Maine. Though marriage equality passed in 2012, and yes, we're recognized a little differently than we have been, but it never goes away. You are gay, and that's not easy to deal with. So we want to be able to put a nod to the community that we're LGBT organization owns this building, but we're also providing services to the people in this building, support services. It's important, I think, to call out that we do have the strength to be able to create affordable housing in Maine. This will be the first 55-plus affordable one owned by an LGBT organization. we don't think it's going to take long to fill it out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you already have a waiting list.
Well, Chris has started an interest list, which has well over 300 names now. And as we go through Pride Month, we'll be tabling at different Pride events with clipboards, asking other people to sign up. But I think the need for housing in Maine now is reaching 80,000 with 80,000 housing units within the next 7 years. This is a drop in the bucket, but I think we're going to be full with a waiting list for years to come to be able to be part of this great endeavor.
Yeah, well, Maine Calling's been working on a series for a year and a half on the housing crisis. I so appreciate you calling in, the owner of the Gardner Real Estate Group, Ed Gardner. Gia, I want to turn to you because one thing we've been talking about through this whole hour is safe spaces and talking about really, really frightening events, murders and fires. And here we are in 2025, and we're in a really fraught time culturally and politically in our country. How safe do you feel today?
Oh, that's a scary question. I still get threats to me as a person, but I hear that from other LGBTQ leaders, especially transgender people today. And that's really unfortunate. And, I think one of the things that we've kind of left out of this story is the lack of trans voices and visibility in the history of LGBTQ rights. We know that Stonewall, and in the late 60s, there were trans people there, of course, but soon after, trans people were not included in the movement. In fact, they were ostracized. And so, it's really important for us to recognize that trans safety is really important today, specifically when we have elected officials and we have a president who's attacking transgender people. Here in Maine, though, we've had some really wonderful people that I want to celebrate. Back in the 90s, Jean Vermette started the first sort of trans meetup group that was life-saving for people. And then Alex Rowan, who formed Maine Transnet in the 2000s, was where I started connecting with other transgender people. And I think that's really been important for transgender people to find those safe spaces. But that lack of visibility and the lack of our stories being told over the last 50 years has made it really complicated in today's political world, because those myths and stereotypes are being mobilized by the opposition. And so I think it's really important during this Pride that we recognize the rights and visibility in the lives of transgender people.
All right. We have just a few minutes left, and I want to turn to you, Megan, and you, Wendy, to reflect on where we are now, because we are talking about history. And Wendy, you are a historian.
Sociologist, actually.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay, I'll still let you talk. How do you feel about where we are today?
I'm heartened that we have basic civil rights protections. I'm disturbed, deeply disturbed by the attacks on principles that I hold dear, like diversity and equity and inclusion. I am horrified by attacks on trans kids in our main schools. And I'm aware that we have a long, hard battle ahead in the next 4 years to try to hold the line on what we've achieved and hopefully to push things forward.
Yeah, Megan.
Same. I think same with what Wendy said, as I feel we're in this position where in the hold the line, it feels very much like for the Mainers who went through the terrible 90s of that push and push and push and push. I think it feels like we're in that era again. I think for the young folks who never went through that, I think in some ways that's heartening of we've been through rough times. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of boots on the ground to hold the line. So if you're out there and you maybe don't have the cash, because who of us of the young group have cash to give away at this point in our lives, put your hands in, get involved, go find a place. I think what's also really heartening is in the old groups, it's DIY all the way through. It's just a bunch of people who say, do you want to do it? Do you want to do it? Do you want to do it? Great. That's four of us. Let's do it. Even if it's not perfect, even if it's not beautiful. So I think if we can find each other again, we can communicate again, we find our people, and we can hold the line.
And Chia, I want to ask you just a little bit in the few minutes we have left about allyship. I suspect, I did not live in Maine then, but I suspect that the Charlie Howard murder not only helped form the gay rights movement today, but also really shocked other people as well into maybe an allyship that they hadn't been a part of before. And I'm wondering if you feel as though today there's something similar happening.
I think that's a really great point, Jennifer, is, we're in the aftermath of Charlie's murder, who was going to stand up? Who was going to be visibly next to or adjacent to LGBTQ people? And some folks stepped back and they didn't want to be connected to that movement, but some people stepped forward. And I think that type of allyship is so important. Allyship is a verb. You really have to take action as an ally. And I think today we're back in that place where we really need our allies to step up and be visible, learn along the way. And I think that's a great opportunity as this Pride season, as allies, is to show up, ask questions, listen, become more involved. I think that's how we make progress. We're not going to make progress alone. We're going to make progress alongside our allies. So I'm hopeful that allies are paying attention or listening, because we definitely need to be stronger and more connected with one another, because that makes our communities much stronger.
Yeah, we're for any Peabody.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Megan. Oh, yeah, that's right. We've just had an entire conversation without talking about Franny Peabody. You have a minute. Go.
So Franny Peabody was an amazing little old grandma who lost her grandson to AIDS. She was an absolute powerhouse. The New York Times called her a powerhouse with pearls. So she's amazing. She was in Portland. She was the head of the Pride Parade every year. She was everybody's grandma. Go be her.
All right. And Wendy, just a few seconds left.
Oh, I'm just so heartened to be in the midst of this group that spoke today, but also the broader community in Maine that's doing such good work and fighting back.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. The voice you just heard, Dr. Wendy Chapkis, a professor and expert on gender, sexuality, and LGBTQ+ rights. at USM. Megan McGregor is also at USM. She's in the Library Instruction and Outreach Librarian, and Gia Drew, Executive Director for Equality Maine. Our sound engineer today was Sam Tracy. Today's program was produced by Maine Public's Dow intern, Eslyn Brotz. And Eslyn, congratulations and thank you. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.